as the Shiso mentioned a few days ago, Rohatsu means the eighth day of the 12th month. In the Gregorian calendar, that's today. Happy Rohatsu. We celebrate Buddha's enlightenment today and all days. Continue, Sashin. And as she mentioned, one of the especially sweet things about Rohatsu Sashin is that Zen communities all around the world are sitting Sashin this week with us. I think, you know, also they celebrate Buddha's birthday and Buddha's parinirvana around the same time, but traditionally it seems that Buddha's enlightenment comes along with the sesshin. That's the big one. If people do one sesshin in a temple, it's often this time. So our mother temples of San Francisco Zen Center and Tassajara and Green Gulch Farm all doing Rohatsu Sashin this week. And our sister temple, Jikoji, doing Rohatsu this week. And I know those three San Francisco ones all... each one has a Shuso and also ends with a Shuso Dharma inquiry ceremony. I don't know at Jikoji, maybe. So. Not this time.
Sometimes.
Uh-huh. And Bukokuji, where I practiced in Japan, they're just finishing. Having not been there for decades, I can picture exactly what's happening there right now. As they finish. Great Vow Monastery doing Rohatsu Sashin up in Oregon. When I think about it, probably about 20 Rohatsu Sashins just on the west coast of America this week. Not to mention hundreds in Japan and Europe and elsewhere in this country. So, how sweet to join so many people in this craziness. Kobun, during Sashin, once said, talking about the Bodhisattva vows, when we think of saving all beings, favorite topic. When one or many appear to be suffering, you cannot turn your head, your mind, away from it. That's the basis of the feeling of saving. That's a nice summary right there, huh? Whatever we actually do, just we don't turn away from suffering. We don't ignore it, and that causes us some pain. You want to help if you can. Like with illness, whether you have the skill to deal with it or you're an experienced surgeon, still you're not sure you can save the person. The problem in this vow is taking it literally and getting confused. So this came up a little bit yesterday, right? We have this, it can get really painful. I think there's so much suffering and what can I do? How can I save all beings? If we take it too literally, that's the problem. Actually, you can do only so much yet you wish you could do more. It's a gap between reality and an idea, but you do not suffer from it. We have our ideal, we want to save all beings, and the reality of, well, this seems impossible. So there's that gap, but you don't suffer from it. The important thing is the connectedness of your mind to something, which keeps your life going with a certain tension, joy, purpose, and a sense of your worthiness to exist, so to speak. So we could see this vow as the important thing is the connectedness of our mind and our intention and our heart to all the suffering beings. We're not turning away, we're not ignoring. This connection keeps us going with a certain tension, joy, purpose, and sense of worthiness to exist, worthiness to be alive. And this, you know, Richard expressed this as burning. Sometimes I feel like that too. This is burning of, I am falling so short in this grand vow. And maybe that's what Cobin's expressing a little more in a little more subdued way as tension. Maybe it doesn't have to be burning, but it keeps us, this connection of our mind with all of these beings keeps our life going with a certain tension, a good tension. Tension, joy, purpose. And maybe particularly connected to this fourth paramita of diligence. We keep going with joyful purpose. Instead of shutting your mind off from all the problems we have today and pretending that you don't know the world, you have to deal with what you've got. If you say that you can only take care of what's inside of your skin and what's outside of your skin is someone else's problem, that doesn't work. Your external body, limitlessly opened, is the larger part of your body, actually. The inside of your skin is a very small part. It's a landmark where your mind is resting. The skin bag is this particular location of our, you know, of our human consciousness. But that's all. And we each have this different location. But I think on the fifth day of Sesshin, we start to sometimes have that sense that I don't end at the edge of the skin, actually. And big mind has no boundaries at all. And yet, at the same time, there's this very tangible sense of location. And skin is, the edge of our skin is more sensitive than ever where it meets the Zafu. Very, very particular, very strong sensation, but that's not the whole story. That's part of our experience. Big part. So big that we often think that's the only part of our experience until we settle very deeply and open more and more and start to sense this larger awareness. I think of it as like our consciousness is our usual body located sense of me as the body location relating to the world as out there. That's dualistic consciousness. But then that whole scenario is happening in this much larger awareness that's not like a self and other awareness. It has no edges at all. And the beautiful thing about that awareness is that awareness actually has no physical pain. There's physical pain happening in this dualistic consciousness, body and mind, maybe quite intensely, but we might even call it the big witnessing awareness that's just like, ooh, there's this very located Kokyo sitting on this particular seat, and his bottom is quite sore where it meets the Zafu. But that's all quite wonderful to me, the big witness that also includes all other beings and the entire universe. I have a problem with my butt, but he doesn't. Big mind. He's not really like exactly enjoying it either. I think he's more neutral than that. Just pure witness. Oh. Is that so? He silently says. So, the inside of your skin, Coben says, is a very small part. It's a landmark where your mind is resting. Whatever exists externally is also all included in your being. It doesn't matter if it appears to be pleasant or unpleasant. The question is how to see each being in its essential nature, not how it appears and not how it should change. This may be just your temporary perception, so you have to be very clear about what exists, not how it should be. It says, the enlightenment business is like becoming rich, not becoming poor. You get so much stuff that you have to take care of others. Sometimes we might talk about the enlightenment business as becoming like extremely poor, because you give up everything. But we could also say it's becoming extremely rich. You have everything, and you're responsible for everything. You have so much stuff, you have to take care of others. In such a state, there is no sense of saving others. The problem is when saving others occurs without the enlightenment experience. Interesting, huh? That's maybe this his earlier point of taking it too literally, because the non-enlightened mind takes everything literally. That's the problem.
Hello.
Hi.
The non-enlightened mind is the one that takes the vow.
Yeah. The non-enlightened mind, I think that's right. Because it... the non-enlightened one wants to line up with the enlightened one, and it would feel like, I think taking this ridiculous vow will help me, little me, line up with big me. We could see it like that. We could, and we, you know, we heard earlier this fall about bodhicitta, the great vow to drop off me for the benefit of all beings, arises, doesn't just come from the small self and doesn't just come from Buddha. It comes in this kano doko. It comes, the actual vow arises when I meet my true nature. So, it feels like it's the little me making the vow, but we could also say big mind is a Buddha is actually helping us make the vow too. With the judgment of good and bad in everyday life, you may feel a little strange when you do something for somebody. Before everybody notices, you may get the sense, I'm doing something wrong, even if you're doing something good. You may have the sense, I'm doing something wrong. If everybody says good, but you feel it's only somewhat good, the signal within you is where you will find the sense of saving. If you follow that? Koban has an interesting way of talking. I hear that as, you do something good, somebody says, that's really good, but you feel like, well, I actually could do it even better. I think that that is, that's a signal of, your vow of saving, or you're feeling like, my vow is bigger than just that little good thing that I just did. He says, if everybody says good, but you feel it's only somewhat good, the signal within you is where you will find the sense of saving. Like, I'm always falling short. Like I tried to tell this story about my patience yesterday, and Liz kindly pointed out that, like, well, what about the patience of these beings you're trying to be patient with? And I saw, like, the bigger picture and felt, this is so embarrassing. And then afterwards I felt, actually, just like, life is totally embarrassing. Just to be alive. And so she and I think we start to feel more and more like, everything I do is like constantly, you know, falling short of the awesomeness of Buddha's vow. So each step is like an embarrassment. But how wonderful to see that. By revealing and disclosing our lack of faith and practice before the Buddha, we melt away the root of transgressions. Is that what you were going to say?
Well, I was going to say, one continuous mistake.
Yeah, one continuous mistake.
Is a beautiful, strong part of our tradition.
Yeah.
That is part.
Yeah. Always falling short, and always joyfully continue anyway. That's patience and diligence working together. Without judgment, Koban says, you may feel okay about what you're thinking or doing, even when it's not thought of as a good thing. This is the other side. Without doing anything, you can also save things. By your own change, things change. So sometimes we feel like somebody says, we do something good, somebody says, great, and we feel like, actually, I'm still falling a little bit short. And sometimes we don't think anything good at all, that it's any good at all. Somebody might even, like, criticize us, but maybe that, what we're doing anyway, is still a part of saving. That's how I hear that is. There's no fixed marks of saving all beings. It's very important not to judge, Koban says. Judgment means to name and measure and finally say good or bad, exist or not exist. You still have concern for others, but free them from your judgment and don't give them the power to judge you, which saves you from judging others. In a complete mind, the sense of judgment exists, but it doesn't determine the intimate relationship of two beings, which is based on compassion and empathy. So, based on this bodhisattva vow, then we see the how the contracted sense of self inside the skin is starts opening and giving pours forth, and then this is balanced by by harmlessness, where sometimes we don't give things. Actually, Vasubandhu even said in the section on giving, he said, actually don't give like weapons, nets and snares, and alcohol and poison and things like this that will things that will harm others. Even though it looks like giving, actually, some things, yeah, maybe it is a kind of giving, but actually don't give. So these, I think these two, giving and harmlessness, work together as a pair. I kind of see it like that. And like one is just, I want to give everything, and then, but actually, just don't give some things here. And then patience and diligence also seem to kind of work as a pair. Diligence is also like, wholeheartedly do everything, but patience is like, but actually don't do some things, like get angry at, don't wholeheartedly get angry, or fight back. So, virya paramita. So if each of these paramitas is like the skin encapsulated self dissolving, making room for something new, this particular self contraction that's being addressed is, we could say, like laziness or negligence. Then it's important to make the distinction between laziness and like resting. It's a bodhisattva's have to rest and take care. But how do we know if it's laziness? It's very hard to tell. But sometimes we have a sense. I'm indulging the small self. And it changes constantly, right? So we start to just, relax our efforts, maybe we might say, in an appropriate way. But then we get kind of, it's very nice. We get used to that. And then it starts shifting over from the appropriate rest to then indulgence. I think it's harder than the other paramitas. They're all hard to tell. Yeah. Yeah, well, this is the whole free will issue.
Well, how do we play with it? How do we
move
ahead?
Yeah. I would say really getting intimate with the sense of this illusory, small, separate self. And how it works, because I think that gives us the clue. So sometimes you could say that's part of cause and effect too. This is we have this illusory sense of self that's causally produced, you know, that's dependently arisen. But that's what we're studying, this self, to forget the self. So in the cause and effect of studying this self, we start to see, oh, now it's operating in this way that, like, now my activity is based on an illusion. How about this? It's still part of cause and effect, but now I see that where I'm coming from is like I'm feeding an illusion. Sometimes we can catch this, I think. Yeah, this is where I would say, like, indulging the small self is kind of like feeding an illusion. I think sometimes it's hard to catch it, but sometimes we can. Like, actually, I don't need to do this. Or I think the way we catch it often is like we feel a little discomfort. We feel a little off when we're aware. We're like, actually, this moment-to-moment activity right now is not in accord with reality.
That feeling won't come unless cause and effect has brought it.
Yeah. This is all cause and effect.
So I can never really own this in a sense. I mean, I'm falling back into determinism, you know, but I'm saying what's a lovely way to deal with determinism? What is a beautiful way?
Yeah, because it.
We work from where we are the best we can.
The lovely way is
lovely way.
Awareness, mindfulness, which is also determined. But that's the pivotal thing. I think we're watching this process of causality unfold. Because usually it's just unfolding, but we don't pay attention to it.
So.
Mindfulness, awareness, attentiveness. Exactly, what great fortune. Because we can't even decide. I mean, if we're going down the path of looking through the lens of determinism here, which I think is quite an enlightened lens, I think it's kind of like pretty close to reality when we're talking about there's no independent self. There's just causes and conditions. It's kind of like determinism. And it does look that way. And from a big perspective. And then, so who decides to pay attention? Right? It's a great blessing. grace. We could say. Is grace causally conditioned? Is grace more is part of determinism too?
And grace is that thing we talked about that's part of the all possibility. Nothing being impossible. The unknown coming out of nowhere.
Yeah. Or I think determinism and cause and effect is the realm, dependent co-arising is the realm of the apparent world, the world of you and I and things. This is how it plays out with nobody in charge. And then you could say then there's the ultimate realm where actually nothing's playing out at all. Nothing's ever happened and nothing ever will happen. So maybe grace is kind of like the meeting of this ultimate non-arising and the world of interdependent arising. And who knows how we got in this mess? Who knows how we got on this incredibly fortunate path? Right? Wasn't our fault. But here we are now. We hear the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors that just say, pay attention. Who said that? Nobody actually said that. You know, that was just causes and conditions from ancient times came together. Those words came out. Some other hand wrote it down. Some other ear heard it. Some other voice spoke it. And that's, it gets passed along. Nobody there. And yet these teachings, the precious Dharma gets passed along with nobody doing it. It's just amazing, right? Causes and conditions keep it alive. So then we here pay attention. Well, how can I really pay attention anyway? Well, I can't. But now that I heard that, it planted a new condition in this mind stream. So now as I start to like contract into the illusion of separate self, what was that I heard earlier? You know, pay attention. Oh, yeah. Who did that? Nobody, but we're part of this particular causal stream called the great vehicle, Dharma. Vasubandhu lived in the 4th century and wrote in Sanskrit. And now there's some pieces of paper with English writing on them. They seem to be causally connected to that ancient one. It's coming through. It's a miracle. It's a total miracle. And that these what are they? They look like people sitting in this room are like sitting here day after day. It's a miracle. That's how we can start to get suspicious. Maybe they're not really people, actually, because people wouldn't do something like that. Maybe they're Buddhas. Vasubandhu says, one who cultivates vigor is diligent at all times in cultivating the accumulation of practices associated with pure conduct and abandoning laziness and refraining from negligence. One's mind remains constantly vigorous and diligent and never retreats or sinks away, even in the midst of endeavors which are weighted down with difficulty and which yield no personal benefits at all. This is the mind of vigor of a bodhisattva. Virya in Sanskrit is related in the Indo-European language to virile, virility, energy and strength. That's often translated as perseverance, persistence, determination, energy, effort, zeal, enthusiasm, and sometimes defined as the joy in doing good. So it's which is I think important to remember that it's not, diligence doesn't mean like grit your teeth and push through the pain. It's kind of like finding a kind of a joyful, enthusiastic way to keep going, which may mean resting. Actually, diligently resting. And celebrating goodness, celebrating another period of Zazen, Sat, celebrating a completion of an event. That joy, I think, keeps us going. And, of course, this paramita applies to all the other ones. To diligently practice giving and harmlessness and and patience, and particularly tends towards the last two of diligent meditative presence and diligently opening the mind of wisdom. This was, I thought, interesting from Robert Aiken Roshi looks into this, the Chinese word qin qin, that's it's translated as virya in these texts. In the Chinese, the first character means essential, unmixed, or refined, spiritual, and is used in everyday language to mean polished rice. Essential, unmixed, refined, white rice. It's found in such terms as single-minded, or the essential point, vigorous and strong, nobility of mind. And then he says, incidentally, with this etymology, we gain a sense of the religious and cultural importance of white rice in the East Asian diet. Using the word for like diligence and effort is made up of white rice. The second character means advance or urge forward, and is found in expressions like to make an assault or to advance in culture. So together these two characters mean the advancement of single-minded spiritual vigor. It's kind of a literal translation. And the Japanese pronunciation of this is shōjin. So you may have heard this term, shōjin ryōri. It's like this kind of like Zen cooking term. So there's like, I think we have a cookbook in here, Shōjin Ryōri cookbook. It's like Japanese temple cooking, using like just little wild plants for to make a very like exquisite cuisine. So in Japan, like, you know, like small portions of little, very carefully arranged things. This is Shōjin Ryōri, vegetarian cooking. So he says one meaning of this refers to meals of herbs, ferns, berries, and tiny wild potatoes that presumably form the diet of sages who live in the mountains. Nowadays, eating these things can become a fad for wealthy gourmets, which I think it is in Japan now. But the original meaning is to live the way of the Buddha as if one were a sage dwelling in modest accommodations and eating what's available while pursuing the way in single-minded manner. So so Shōjin Ryōri is like virya food, effortful. So since it's Rohatsu, the day that Buddha's enlightenment is celebrated, with this, you know, these events leading up to Buddha's enlightenment are like the ultimate story of virya paramita, are they not? Wow. The sage of the Shakyas was, you know, as legend goes, according to the sutras, in his own words, he, due to causes and conditions, right? How did he make this effort? Well, as Richard wonderfully pointed out, he didn't, right? Why did that particular person make this incredible effort and realize the way? It wasn't him. It was causes and conditions going back, infinitely into beginningless time. Causes and conditions coming together, cause and effect playing out, and you know, following through, because we can assume that that person, Siddhartha Gautama, also had this sense of location, had a sense of, here's a bag of skin with lots going on inside and outside of it, and how shall I live? How shall I live this life? And so coming through this body and mind, this is, I think, the danger of determinism. If we take it, if we don't fully investigate determinism, then we can say, well, I won't do anything because I can't do anything. I'll just watch it happen. So,
you know. That wouldn't be determinism. This determinism would take you to a point where you wouldn't be like that.
It might, or it might not, right? How would we know?
Whatever it would do.
So, I think the problem is when we, when the small self, uses the wonderfully dharmic teaching of determinism as an excuse to not practice virya paramita. Right? It's kind of like, because it's kind of like the I is saying, I actually want a break from the responsibility or something, right? And so, since I can't do anything anyway, I won't. Whereas it's more, and then the other extreme is like, I have the responsibility, it's all about me, I'm the only one that can do it, is also a delusion, right? So, the middle way here, there's always a middle way, right? That doesn't fall into, either side. It's very subtle, and it just comes to mind. I think this is the fox koan here, right? Does an enlightened person fall into cause and effect or not? And the answer came, no, because it's all determined. Enlightened person no longer is pulled around by cause and effect because they see there's no self that's being pulled around by it, right? But then, due to giving that, the one who gave that answer then like fell into this fox body for 500 lifetimes because like cause and effect is still playing out. So then his question is that okay? The koan kind of plays with that. Yeah, maybe okay. 500 lives as a fox, okay. But he wanted to be released at some point. So he asked Baijong, the fox being, asked Baijong, doesn't an enlightened person fall into cause and effect or not? And Baijong said, it doesn't obscure cause and effect. Enlightened person is not blind to cause and effect. So he didn't say whether he falls into it or not. But we have to pay attention. Just pay attention to cause and effect. Who's paying attention? Well, cause and effect is paying attention to cause and effect. But that changes things from if cause and effect is not paying attention to cause and effect. Strange how this works. Now this sounds like the Buddha's really trying to work with this little contracted one inside and with great zeal and virya paramita. He says, as I strove to subdue myself, as who strove to subdue who? But that's what we could say. We might say, as this body and mind, this particular location of body and mind strove to subdue the little illusion of contraction inside, to subdue and release it. I don't mind talking that way. This body and mind will practice the way to see through this self. But here it sounds like this I strove to subdue myself. Maybe two different things. There's the big I is striving to subdue the small I. We might hear it like that. Beside the broad Naranjara River, near the Bodhi tree, absorbed unflinchingly to gain the true surcease of bondage here, Namuchi, or Mara, came and spoke to me with words all garbed in pity thus. what a pity. What a ancient sounding translation. A religious sounding translation. Poetic verse. Mara, the evil one. There's nothing more than this just illusory little contracted guy saying, "Why don't you get out of here now, Kokyo? It's time to stop." He came to me and spoke with words all garbed in pity thus, "Oh, you are thin and you are pale and you are in death's presence too. A thousand parts are pledged to death, but life still holds one part of you. Live, sir. Life is the better way. You starving yourself on the banks of the river. You can gain merit if you live. Come, live the holy life and pour libations on the holy fires," like with the Brahmin priests. "Just do some ceremonies. And thus a world of merit gain. What can you do by struggling now? The path of struggling too is rough and difficult and hard to bear." Mara said. Now Mara, as he spoke these lines, drew near until he stood close by. The Blessed One replied to him as he stood very close. "Maras, keep your distance." But Mara comes very close to the Blessed One and said, and the Blessed One said, "Oh, evil one, oh cousin of the negligent, you have come here for your own ends. Now merit, I need not at all. Let Mara talk of merit then to those that stand in need of it." I don't need any more merit. I'm like on the Bodhi seat now, okay? "For I have faith and energy, and I have understanding too. So while I thus subdue my little self, why do you speak to me of life? There is this wind that blows can dry even the river's running streams. So while I thus subdue myself, why should it not dry up my blood? As the blood dries up, then bile and phlegm run dry. The wasting flesh becalms the mind. I shall have more of mindfulness, of understanding. I shall have greater concentration. For living thus, I come to know the limits to which feeling goes." It's just painful feeling. There's more going on here than this. "My mind looks not to sense desires. You see a being's purity. Your first squadron, Mara, so this is these, I think it's the Mara's nine squadrons, Mara's nine armies. They're all like part of just this little homunculus. The little guy is saying, "Come on, Buddha, get off the seat. Just at least, not tonight." "Your first squadron, Mara, is sense desires. Your second is called boredom." Are you going to be able to sit here hour after hour without getting utterly bored? "Then hunger and thirst compose the third, and craving is the fourth. The fifth is sloth and torpor, while cowardice is the sixth. Uncertainty or doubt is the seventh. The eighth is malice paired with obstinacy. gain honor and renown besides, and ill-won notoriety, self-praise and belittling others. These are your squadrons, Mara. But I will stand up to them. These are the evil ones' fighting squadrons. None but the brave will conquer them to gain bliss by the victory. I fly the banner that denies retreat. Shame on this life of delusion here, I say. Better I die in battle now than choose to live on in defeat. There are ascetics and Brahmins that have surrendered here at this point, and they are seen no more. They do not know the paths the pilgrim travels by. So seeing Mara's squadrons now arrayed all around with elephants, I sally forth to fight that I may not be driven from my post. You serried squadrons which the world with all its devas cannot defeat, I shall now break with understanding as with stone a raw clay pot. So Buddha is not going to fight with Mara with weapons. He's going to fight with understanding. I bring forth my understanding. I see you, Mara. You're all of this stuff. Your nine armies trying to knock me off the seat with great virya paramita, determination and diligence. I'll continue to sit here. Not that it will be easy. Because Mara sure knows how to put up a fight. We love him. We love him. You gotta hand it to him or her. What we are?
Worthy there.
Worthy adversary. Yeah, you know. And this is, you know, the old Indian way of talking about these things is like battle scenes, right? The whole like Bhagavad Gita. And so it's, you know, written by virile men old India. So it has its drawbacks maybe that because I think virya paramita can be doesn't have to be like painted as like a fighting image, right? Sometimes it might be useful. Strong, fiery beings with bared fangs and vajra stabbers are gonna obliterate Mara. But sometimes it's Avalokiteshvara, supremely relaxed. Mara's like attacking with the army. Well, watch this, Mara. Hi, Mara. You know, actually, I love you. What? You can't say that to me. No, I do, Mara, because you're part of me too. You're okay. Do your thing. Go ahead. Go ahead. I love it. Yes.
I just was reminded as you were enacting Avalokiteshvara, a story from Jarvis Masters, who practices in prison in San Quentin. He's on death row, and he's a practitioner, and he writes.
Yes.
He tells a story about a fight on the prison yard. And those are really heavy duties.
Yeah.
And they're so fear-based that people are... have to just be tough all the time.
Yeah.
So there was a fight going on. Oh, and it was involving a bird, right? Like, that a bird, a seagull, was going to be killed. And he stopped them, and he called out, cried out in the middle of the fight something about, you know, don't hurt that bird. And the guy got in his face like, what do you mean, don't hurt that bird? Who the, you know, blank. So I'll take, do you think you are? What, you know, what's going on? And Jarvis, what came out of him was, that bird's got my wings, man. And it totally stopped. And the guys were like, what? It's like somehow that they got it.
Yeah.
That bird's got my wings. And then they teased him about it later on. Like, oh, God, remember when you said that? But it stopped them. It stopped the violence.
Yeah, beautiful image.
That in a way, it was like Avalokiteshvara.
Yeah.
Just spontaneous arising in this completely unlikely circumstance.
Yeah. That bird's got my wings and your wings and all of our wings.
They knew it. They got it somehow. Inside them, they just got it. And it cut through all the protective veneer that they live with in that.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful story.
Yeah, thank you.
I probably mangled its telling, but I'm sure well, found that's, its original.
That's the heart of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And diligent, effortful, zealous patience. Patient receptivity. Working together, patience and diligence. I think we can also see as like yin and yang. Diligence and patience are like yin and yang, working an active diligence and a receptive patience working together as one whole. And giving and harmlessness we can also see as an active yang giving and a receptive, gentle harmlessness. Working together as one whole. May our intention equally pervade the Dharma Dhatu with our diligent effort and great patience, benefiting all beings with our subtle work and deepening compassion. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.